Blog Talk Radio.
Serving up the beats and making it hot. It's DJ IQ.
Runway. The right way. Rod Sweat.
Soul Shaker.
witch doctor.
Pussy, 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 p
that I left.
Everyone who knows. I think, do we have an echo here? Is everything okay there, switchboard? Hi, America. Hi, everybody out there in Radio Land and across the lands and the waters all up and down the United States. What's going on? Let me change. Back here on the air again. I was giving my shout out to everybody as far as saying hello to everyone. I think it's some type of mix up with the machines because I was here and now I'm not there and then I'm back here. But anyway, I'm back here tonight. If you guys was listening to my show last week and the week before last, you know this is the Sister to Sister for Real show. And I'm here to basically give a platform for all of us ladies and femme queens to come up here and, you know, deal with issues and things that we have going on in the boardroom and in real life. Last week I spoke about making a show dedicated to, you know, Mary is my favorite person, so I love her so much. So I thought of giving a show to dedicate my life, and I was actually going around getting some real interesting stories for you guys, some things that you guys can learn from and hear about and even can relate to with your own personal issues or your own personal things that you're going through. So tonight, you guys, we're going to have the legendary CEO, Jasmine Couture. This interview are only for real bitches. You all have to be real to be interviewed. You have to be able to speak and tell something about yourself that nobody doesn't know. Of course, Jasmine has been one of those people, and she's not been having or nor have she ever been afraid to tell her story, and that's what we're going to have. We're going to talk about where she come from. We're going to talk about all the things she had to endure to get to where she is, the $5,000 club. And, you know, as you all know, that the $5,000 club went a long time before the actual collections ball, and she's having several of those. We're going to talk to Jasmine about some of the personal things that she has gone through in her life, and we're going to talk to Jasmine as far as all the professional and good things that she has come out of in her life. So I want you all to go call your girlfriends, call your friends, because this ain't Oprah, this is Barbara Walters, right? And these interviews are going to be on and popping. We have the collections ball this weekend, Saturday, October 15th in Richmond, Virginia, $15,000, $55,000 for the Grand March, $10,000 for the house with the most point. I'm sure all of you guys are going to be in the building, and everybody's looking forward to have safe fun and to enjoy ourselves. It's going to be a blast. It's a 3-day weekend, and once again, she did it again. So we're going to dedicate this night because my birthday is Thursday, guys. Happy birthday to me. And I definitely think about going to Vogue night. So I need to get out there, you know, because I'm 15 years old now. So I need to get out there and have a little fun. But I want to take as much time as I can to dedicate this platform to the person behind the $5,000, the person behind the $5,000 club, excuse me, the person behind the collection board, the person behind some of the awards board, a person that has collaborated with many other people in the ballroom scene to give you guys all that y'all have had. So look forward to interviews look forward to interviews by Tony Revlon. I'm going to have Tony Revlon on the phone. We also know he's very real, so look forward to that day. I'm going to also get the opportunity to interview the pioneer icon, R.R. Chanel. I will have different, if you are real and you are an icon, a pioneer, you have a story. See, because you have to have some type of experience to be in this interview. And if y'all seen Jasmine, she has a lot of it. You know, she has went from one thing, from a butch queen to a femme queen, and now she's a full-fledged woman with her own business and giving you guys everything you need and cater to at these balls. So let's give a round of applause for Jasmine. CEO Couture, who never ever let go of that name, if y'all never noticed it. And I want to cater to this night about being her. Now, if any of you people on the phone and you have how we're going to do the My Life thing is I will interview Jasmine. And after a certain amount of time, if you would like to say hi, if you would like to ask her questions, if you would like to, you know, just get into her story, or if you're feeling very emotional about it, there will be a time where you guys can press 1 and you all can come up here and you can speak to Jasmine and you can see, you know, and you can tell her how you feel or what you thought about her story or, you know, or how it even relates to your own. So this right here is not just, I'm not taking the time out and not getting dressed to just be interviewing a nobody, just to have a topic or just say, no, this is very important because from her story, your story may be told and it may also save your dreams. So if you're young and you think that you can't be where you can't be in a better place today, the devil's a liar. If you're young and you're hooked on balls and things are not working out your way and you don't think that things can change around, the devil's a liar again. The saying is what goes around comes around. If it goes around and goes around for bad, then what makes you think it can't go around for good? So I'm going to see if Jasmine, because I'm not going to be I'm doing any callers. I'm going to interview Jasmine. I'm going to tell a lot of her. She's going to be very intimate. If you press 1, I hope my girlfriend London is here tonight. If you press 1, I want you to be very respectful. You can ask anything you want, and no insults on this night. And I'm not looking for you to come up here and tell me about your issues and your problems. This is a very positive night for a very positive reason for a lot of positive things. So let's not take too much. I'm going to take too much more of you guys' time. Hi, chat room. How are you? I'm sure the mother hen is communicating to you guys. Hello, overall East Coast mother, Ms. Rahi, if you are in the winds and switchboard and everybody in her background. So I want to see switchboard. Let me know if Jasmine will be able to come on or how much time is she going to need. You have to sometime fly into London to get her together, you know. Let me know how much time is she going to actually need if I need to. Oh, she's here. Yes, that's it. Jasmine?
Hey, Nicole.
Hi. First of all, let me just take out the moment to say I so appreciate because, you know, the questions and the things that I have to ask you are very revealing, and you basically are coming out the closet tonight. And I appreciate you taking the time and coming on here and doing such a real show, because you know I'm a real bitch. You've known me for since I was a little boy. So, you know, I'm going to pretty much say the real, real things or give you the real things. So I really appreciate you coming on the show to give your story, your life, your dreams. I greatly appreciate that. How are you, Jasmine?
I'm fine. Trying to get ready for Saturday and stuff.
There's a lot going on. There's a lot of different categories and stuff because, you know, I'm probably sure that this is easy for you. You've been doing it for so much, for so long.
It never gets easy. It gets harder.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, after doing 3 days of events, what do you think? So,
you know,
I'm going to start off with you. You know, whatever you don't wish to answer, you can just say, I'm sure that's not going to happen. But I want to start off with letting the people know not where you come from as far as ballroom, but a little bit where you come from as far as creation. Maybe where did you grow up at? You know, and what town did you grow up at? And did you live in a single home, or did you both live with your mom or your dad?
Wow. Okay. You know, in all these years, I never did an interview with no one. So,
well, thank you.
You just
gotta
kinda
excuse
me. I am shy a little. So I'm going to try my best. The reason why I agreed to this interview is because I'm getting older, and I see so much that's happening within the ballroom community. And, you know, a lot of stuff that we as adults and stuff go through, a lot of kids don't realize that we have went through what they're going through. And hopefully my story can kind of help, you know, change. If it's one person, help change them a little, help them, you know, let them know they're not alone. One of the things that touched me a lot is the fact that over the past, you know, year or so, I've been seeing so many gay teenagers killing themselves very young and stuff. And, you know, that's the only reason why I'm sharing my story is because I want people, especially to the younger generation, realize that, you know, you're not alone, you know, in what you're going through. You may feel alone and stuff, but we all have a story. We all go through similar things. I'm one who, I still struggle to this day, but I'm one who has, you know, done my best to make it, and I keep fighting every day to keep what I got. So I can, you know, that's how I will share my story and how I will talk about it. Sitting here talking about it, you know, is going to be kind of sensitive on my end, because one of the things that helped me to survive and keep going was not dwelling on the past, not looking at the past, just looking at the future and fighting for the future. So for me to sit here and talk about the past, it's kind of like, you know, a little sensitive area with me. So you have to excuse me if I may stutter, or, you know, I'm not a very emotional person. I'm not going to break down and cry, but,
yeah,
you know, just kind of have to, you know, excuse me a little bit, you know, talking about it, because it's been kind of hard, but...
You'll be fine. Just take your time. And I'm sure these people, because, you know, everybody has a story. And in order to be where you are in your life, you have to have some type of experience or a story. So you have to have something to be able to tell somebody. So,
But one of the things that helped me to, you know, that got me to where I'm at right now is the fact that I knew I never wanted to look back or turn back around and face what I was facing. A little bit about me. I grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. You know, I grew up not with a strong family. I'm half black, half Puerto Rican, and I was split among my Spanish side and my black side, you know, the majority of my life growing up. You know, when things weren't going right, you know, on my, you know, my black side, I would be taken to my Spanish side, and when things weren't going right there, I was, you know, back and forth all the time.
Well, what side is black and what side is Spanish?
My mom was black and my dad was Puerto Rican.
And is there a lot of siblings like that around? I mean, as far as your mother and your father, is there more people, brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother from a separate. My mom got remarried, and he was he's younger than me. He's like 25 now. But, just him. You know, I don't acknowledge my Spanish side as much as I do. You know, I did my black side, because one thing about me is, you know, my mom, she was, you know, she was on drugs. I lost her in the early 90s, you know, to AIDS and, you know, things of that sort.
How old were you?
And, huh?
How old were you?
I don't remember.
Oh, wow. You sure? Okay, I'm going to go ahead with that.
I just catch how I say things. I lost my mom in the early 90s. You know, no matter what she did, you know, as many times as she was in and out of jail and no many times she was in and out of rehab, I still loved her. I didn't approve of people talking about her negatively. And my Spanish side really talked about her a lot negatively and in a negative way. And I didn't approve of it. So I still clinged on to, you know, that side of my family. I grew up in a household that I had four uncles, my grandmother, my mom, and really my grandmother raised me on that side of the family, on my black side, my mom's side. Uh-huh. And my mom was in and out of jail, and she was, you know, in and out of rehab and stuff. And I was raised around my uncles. And over the course of the years growing up, you know, as a young, you know, teenager, I buried three of my uncles. When I say buried, my family did practice the Muslim religion. And if anyone knows anything about the Muslim religion, you know, you don't go through embalming or anything like that. You're actually buried, you know, right away. And the family, male figures of the family, you know, go through the process of washing the body and, you know, wrapping it in prayer, wrapping the person in prayer cloth and things of that sort. So I lost four of my uncles, one of them to a drug overdose, one of them to another drug overdose, he was in the attic. He was found on the toilet. The other one, I lost him to the virus. And another one also got a bad bag of drugs, and it was actually muscle relaxer, and it went straight to the brain and just, you know, killed him. So I went through a family of losing, you know, my closest relatives one by one, and then also losing my mom, which caused me to, you know, have so many feelings towards that area where I grew up at. And, you know, every time I looked around the streets and certain neighborhoods and stuff, I would always remember my family, and I just couldn't be there no more. I never wanted to be there. And that was one of the things that caused me to fight and leave and never look back.
How long were you, where exactly were you when you were going through the barriers? Were you still living in Patterson at that time?
Yeah, I was living in Patterson for... yeah, I was living in Patterson for pretty much all of my life.
And how long did you live in Patterson?
I left Patterson when I was like 17. I left home when I was 15 years old, but I left Patterson when I was 17.
And where did you venture? 17? At 17? Oh wow! You know what? There's a lot of 17-year-old children that leave home at that time. It's pretty much a regular age to have left home. But where did you go when you left home at 17?
Well, once I finished, you know, school and stuff, my grandmother on my Spanish side, she wanted me, she knew what I was going through. I was doing like a lot of bad things back then. You know, I was just your average crazy teenager, you know, just doing crazy things. And my grandmother wanted, you know, me to come to Florida at one time. And, you know, she'd say, oh, go down to Florida, I'm going to buy a house. Just, you know, go down there and tell me what it's like. But that was really her way of trying to get me out of the Patterson area, because she knew where, you know, the life I was heading in. So, you know, a lot of things was going on with my family and stuff, and I, you know.
Was you always very feminine? Nah, feminine. Yeah, because I don't. I've known you for a very long time. I never recollect seeing you in any type of masculine form or anything. So coming up with your grandmother and them three uncles, how did they deal with that? Because I'm pretty sure you've always been the same.
Yeah. Well, at a younger age, when I was probably around 8 or 9. Reason why I got thrown back and forth so many times between my family is when I was around 8 or 9, I was molested by one of my uncles, but not on my black side, on my Spanish side.
Really?
Yeah, and when that happened and my mom found out, actually it was happening for a while, but when my mom found out, she snatched me away from my Spanish side and put me on, you know, I lived with my other side of the family. So I had 4 uncles, but they never did anything to me. But it was a lot of teasing. You know, we were, you know, very close in age, you know, not too many years apart, you know, things of that sort. My uncles, when they passed away, they were 19, 23, 28 and 32 when they all passed away. So, you know, we were all kind of close in age. Not close in age, but it was, they were just young-minded, let's say. You know, they were just still teasing and things of that sort. So I went through a lot of verbal attacks on that side of the family and, you know, physical attacks on the other side.
Wow. And how did you actually tell your mom about you being molested?
No, she found out when I was very young, and she kind of she knew something was wrong, and I told my uncle, one of my other uncles, and I told him what was going on, and she kind of knew from there. And then, you know, it all blew up very crazy within the family and stuff.
Wow. And, yikes. So this is from your Spanish side. Wow. Oh, wow. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So how would you say that the molestation had anything to do with, you know, how you end up living your life, periodly, or?
I wouldn't say that. I don't blame what happened to me, you know, on what was going on in that house. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I've always had feelings the way that I feel now. I've always felt a certain way about myself as long as I can remember. Even young pictures of me that I don't even remember, they were still those little cunty boy poses and things like that. So I can't really say, you know, that that's the reason why, because of the molestation. You know, I probably that's the reason why the molestation took place. I have no idea. I just know that, you know, that's what happened.
And how did you tumble upon coming out of the closet? And was that hard for you and hard for your family?
I think what happened was not really coming out of the closet. I think, you know, people knew in general. But I will say one thing about secrecy in a family. I always call that a story itself. Really quickly, when I was probably in 8th grade, when I lived with my Spanish grandmother, the uncle that molested me, he was on drugs. You know, he started using drugs at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm a teenager, so, you know, nothing's really, you know, nothing's happening. I'm going to school, actually had a job at that time, and one of my first jobs in 8th grade, and, you know, buying CD players, buying this, buying that, you know,
mm-hmm.
feeling good
mm-hmm.
about personal things that you're buying. You're on your own now. Not on your own, but you're actually purchasing your own items and your own clothing and things like that. And my uncle was constantly stealing from my grandmother, stealing from me. And one thing that happened was me and my grandmother got into an argument, and I told my grandmother, you know, you're always taking up for him. Why is he even here? He's ruining my life. He's always stealing my stuff. And you don't do nothing. You still allow him to come here. And she's like, oh, shut up. This is my house. And da-da-da-da-da. And I said, well, I don't have to live here. I'll go live with my mother. I'm so sick of it. He's been ruining my life ever since I was a child when he was raping me. And my grandmother came out and she said, shh, you're not supposed to remember that. You're not supposed to talk about that.
Yeah.
And when I seen it on her face, what she was saying, and the way she said it, I looked at her and I'm like, are you serious? And
were you afraid?
Supposed to forget that? I wasn't afraid. I was gagging that she was using the words, you're supposed to forget about that. You're supposed to not talk
mm-hmm.
about that.
Mm-hmm.
No one is supposed to know. And when she said that, I really blew up. You know, I went off on her and said, oh, really? And that's when I came out and told the whole family, you know, everything. You know, this is what he's been doing to me. I called my father, who lived in Virginia at that time. I wound up calling him and said, did you know what your brother was doing to me when I was 8 and 9 years old? And he didn't even know what was happening. And then he came to Patterson and went off on my grandmother. You know, I just kind of blew up. So when I blew that up and said everything to everybody about that,
mm-hmm.
then it really came out like, wow, you know, he's in eighth grade and his mouth is, nobody can cut his, you know, his mouth is fierce, bottom line. You know.
Okay, by this, so by this time you was in eighth grade.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I was in eighth grade. And I completely snapped at that point, you know, and it was like I wasn't keeping my mouth shut, and I didn't care what people felt, you know, I didn't care. So I shared it with everyone, you know, and they said, you know, why does it have to, I questioned, why does it have to be this way? You know, this is what happened, and, you know, why does it have to be this? Why does everything have to be a hush? And, you know, little things just kept happening after that, you know, moving mm-hmm. back in with my mom in the projects, being on drugs, and, you know, it was just a lot of stuff that was happening there in the projects, and me and my mom used to go at it and constantly arguing, well, you're a drug addict, well, you're a faggot, well, you got needles under your bed, well, you got this, you do that. I mean, it was constantly, you know, a back and forth thing for years, you know. It was a lot of stuff that happened between us. And that was kind of growing up.
So, oh, wow. Well, you know, I personally can totally relate to, especially the uncle stories, the stories of, you know, your uncles and them, and I'm so sorry, actually, although you're really past that, about all of those losses that happened to you at such a young age. That must be heavy. So how did you end up, you know, wandering, you know, to the village where I met you and, you know, out and into that land, the gay land, you know, the land of the free?
Well, what happened is that going back to when I left, you know, Patterson, and I moved to Florida for about a year. My mom was still alive, and this is right out of high school. I moved to Florida. My mom was still alive back in Patterson. She was like one of the last ones left. It was just her and my grandmother
mm-hmm.
and my younger brother. As I lived in Florida, probably the worst thing that ever happened with me was, you know, coming to Florida, because now I'm a young adult. I have this freedom. You know, I have a new life, and it, you know, I just wound up getting mixed up with, you know, a lot of crazy people. You know, I was hanging out so much. I was sniffing coke, drinking all the time, you know, drinking 40s, like, you know, like
and this
water.
Was what you experienced in Florida?
Not
to cut you up, but I
just
wanted to make sure we're in the right
around me. I had no one. You know, it was just more or less me on my own. When I first came down, my grandmother sent me down. She sent me down with a friend of the family's, but then I just branched off on my own. And, you know, I was just doing a lot of crazy stuff, you know, a lot of crazy stuff. And that's when I started finding myself. You know, as far as like, wow,
well,
you know, I can dress up and no one, you know, and no one's going to judge me, you know, and no one's going to notice me. No one's going to recognize me, you know, little things like that. So that all started in that process, you know, when I was on my own in Florida. And, you know, I got locked up. You know, I was, you know, I had a friend who was stealing, cars and car radios and amps and things of that sort. And I was a hustler. I was trying to make money. So he would steal the stuff and I'll take it to the pawn shop and sell it. He would steal, go to, you know, New York and Philadelphia and steal cars and bring them down. And I would drive them around. And, you know, one time I got locked up for driving a stolen car that I didn't even know was actually, I knew it was something fishy with it, but I didn't know it was actually a, they gun jacked, you know, they jacked somebody with a gun somewhere in Boston and brought the car down. And I got arrested for that. So I was in and out of jail. I was just doing a lot of things. And it got so out of hand that I wasn't even contacting my family. And one thing that my mom told me during her sickness, you know, when, you know, while she was sick, she said, if I ever stay in the hospital for a certain amount of days, I'm not coming home. And I tried calling her a few times, and I kept getting voicemail. And I wound up calling my grandmother, and she said, you know, your mother's been trying to reach you for like a week. And she's been in the hospital for the past 2 weeks. And at that point, I knew. You know, mind you, I had coke on my nose when I was talking to my grandmother, and I just dropped everything. And I just reached and got my bag, and I knew right there everything was going to change. And got on a plane the next morning and flew out to Patterson and got a chance to see my mother, thank God, and talk to her. You know, when I did walk in the room, she told me, you know, you're beautiful. You know, that was one of her words. She loved that. And I let my hair start growing out. And she said, I love your hair. You know, she said, you're beautiful and things of that sort. And we talked for a little bit. And I was supposed to bring my younger brother to see her the next day. But the next day she wound up dying that evening. And I had to go home and explain to my brother what happened. And I was just, you know, devastated.
Sure.
And I was so upset. You know, I had some money. I was so upset that after I buried my mom, you know, we buried my mom a few days later, that Saturday, I contacted the airport and found, you know, I tried to find the closest, you know, the first flight out that morning out of New Jersey, I just wanted to run, but I didn't want to run back to Florida. And that first flight out was a flight to Atlanta. And I got on that flight, and I wound up at an airport, and I didn't know where I was going, who I was going to see. I didn't know no one in Atlanta or anything like that. And went to a hotel and just cried and cried and cried, and then started my journey in life, you know, to just move forward. And I wound up in Atlanta, and I stayed there, got a job. I was working for Ticketmaster. Met some people. I started working at a nightclub, at a gay nightclub. I was working there. That's where I met Raquel. And Raquel had just moved from Texas to Atlanta at that time. And me and Raquel hit it off right away. You know,
I really didn't know
nothing about the ballroom scene, huh?
Yeah, you're really close. I never knew that you and Raquel were. Really
yeah, this
close,
was way before ballroom scene. There wasn't even balls going on in Atlanta back then. You know, this was way before the ballroom scene or anything. This is when 708 used to be called Loretta's, if anybody knows about Atlanta. And, you know, I used to work at Loretta's. And, you know, me and Raquel became roommates. And, you know, we were really close. And, you know, about a year later after that, I said that I didn't want to be in Atlanta no more. Atlanta was just crazy. And that's when I moved back to New Jersey, but I could not stay in New Jersey. I was there for like a week, and I wound up moving to Brooklyn, New York. And that's where everything started, you know, as far as the whole Jasmine Couture creation.
Yes. Hold out all your my questions for that. I have to open up my book because that's where, you know, your life really changed big. I'm sure when you met the different people that you still actually know today, or when you were in Atlanta, was you aware of the whole ballroom thing and the things that, you know, the ballroom scene?
The people that I knew in Atlanta that were aware that I was aware of balls with, I didn't know about balls back then when I lived in Atlanta, but I knew Jihad. Jihad was back and forth in Atlanta at that time, Jihad Ebony. And me and Jihad were very, very cool, very, very close. And he used to always tell me about these balls that was happening in New York, but I never knew about them. I never seen them. You know, back then, I didn't even see DVDs. Well, there was no DVDs. It was back, I didn't see no tapes on them. So I just knew that there was these things, and he used to tell me, bitch, you were turning for drag's face and drag's realness and this and that and things like that. You need to come to New York and, you know, little things like that. So I never knew. I just knew of this world, you know, that people were talking about, but I never knew what it was.
So okay, well, I want to not move too fast on how you come in there, because there's some interesting things. So when you Jihad tells you about these different things and you're on your journey, you have already met Starsha, you know Jihad, people that, well, you said Starsha wasn't even at the boards at the
not
time.
Not Starsha, Raquel.
Raquel, sorry. So sorry, Starsha. So sorry, Raquel. No disrespect. Okay, when you get to New York City, and you went to Patterson, of course you have family or friends or whatever around there. How do you manage to weave yourself into the Big Apple now? And
I went back to Patterson after Atlanta, and it was just still too hard for me with the memories of my family and stuff there. And I said I did not want to be there. I want to be in New York. And I did not want to go back to the South. I did not want to go back to Florida or Atlanta. I want to go to New York. I just want to go to New York. And I forget how it was. I want to say it was a newspaper or something. I wound up calling a rooming house in Brooklyn, over by Fort Greene Park. And I wound up calling this one place, and the guy was real nice, him and his wife, and they said they had a room, and it was like $75 a week or something like that. And I said, you know, I could afford it and stuff, and they told me to come see it. So I got on the bus and, you know, the train and stuff, and I went to see it. And, you know, it was cute, you know, and I said I want to stay. So I wound up staying and moving in New York, But then, of course, the money started running out. And I wound up getting on welfare and getting food stamps and stuff. And that's when I think a law was passed or something. And if you were a single individual with no, you know, kids or anything like that, that they had you work. You know, you still had to work to receive your benefits. So they wound up sticking me in Brownsville at one of the welfare centers, and I used to work at one of the departments there, like in the mailroom, and I think it was like the L&S department or something like that. And I used to have to get up and actually go to work just to receive my little $100 and stuff, and they paid my rent and everything. But I was on welfare.
Was it like $100 in food stamps? Like, because, I remember back then it was like $68.50. Remember the $68.50
like
and then $120?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Okay, something like that. So when, but let me ask you just a few of the questions that I had written down. Okay, because you talked about, you know, your parents and coming forward in the land and everything. Well, who would actually? I've never asked that. CEO Couture, who would be your gay mother and father or your mentor?
Well, what wound up happening, you know, being in New York, you know, just going back and forth to work and stuff, I wound up, you know, calling chat lines and, you know,
CB.
You know, just fucking around and, you know, being on chat lines and stuff. And I wound up meeting a guy that was, you know, who was playing trade on a chat line. His name was Terrence. And when me and Terrence wound up meeting, he told me to meet him somewhere in the village. It was right across the street from McDonald's by the basketball courts. And we wound up meeting over there. And when we seen each other, we kind of laughed because he was just, you know, just as cunty as I was. And we just wound up, you know, just laughing and keying and becoming the best of friends. And me and Terrence introduced me, you know, to a lot of stuff. You know, he knew about the balls. He knew about the people. But he just wasn't really a ballroom personality. He just knew about it from other people he used to talk to and mess around with. So he would tell me about balls and everything. And I remember one time on the radio station, I won tickets to see a movie premiere. It was actually Tales from the Hood. And I told Terrence, we got to get to that movie theater by 7 o'clock, and, you know, I'm going to meet you at the movie theater. It was in Times Square. So he was like, okay, well, I'm going to get on this train. And I said, I'm going to get on that train. So the train I got on took me, I forget where I exited from, but I was over there on 43rd and 8th, I think 43rd and 7th or whatever, where Sally's 2. And when I got off the train and I walked past Sally's, I started seeing these femme queens. And it was like really my first time seeing the New York femme queens compared to the Atlanta girls. The Atlanta girls were more drag-ish, pageantry-type girls. But when I started seeing the femme queens of New York, you know, the bodies, the titties, the ass and stuff, I was like, oh, my God. And I had to look, and I kept looking, but I'm running to this movie theater, and winding up getting to the movie theater late, and, you know, we couldn't get in. So Terrence said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, I just passed a whole bunch of these girls. Let's go back over there. So we wound up going to that corner. And it was probably like 8 o'clock, 7:30, 8 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget that first night I stood on that corner with him, and I could not leave until the sun came up. Because
you mean
I was
any interested
so
people out there that
everything.
Corner? Did you meet any interested people on the corner that night that you can remember?
Oh, my God. It turned into a daily thing hanging out over there by Port Authority, by Sally's. And that's when I started seeing all the girls. You know, Show World was right across the street. Danielle, Octavia, all used to come out, be walking in and out of Sally's. And Octavia was the first one who approached me. Her and Danielle was actually walking out. And then Octavia says, are you a boy or a girl? And I started laughing. I was like, I'm a boy. And she's like, no, baby, don't ever tell nobody that you're a girl. And I was like, oh, my God. And then Danielle was like, bitch, look at her hair. And they was all touching my hair and touching my face. And I was just so amazed to have these two beautiful women talking to me and giving me all these compliments and stuff. And right then and there, I don't know what it triggered, but it started the process. It just, you know, from there, it just was like, oh, my God. And then I used to always come to Sally. I used to go to Show World, and I used to see Octavia. She's like, come on, Mama, let's go to the movie. And we would go to the movies only to watch the first 15 minutes or 30 minutes of the movie just to leave. Danielle, I wound up noticing that I lived right around the corner from Danielle when she lived in Brooklyn at her condo, because one time I was washing clothes and she happened to walk into the laundromat to use the phone. And she was like, don't I know you from, you know, from Midtown? And I was like, yeah. And I'm like smiling. She was like, come here, come with me. And then she wanted me to walk with her to the store, and she took me to her house. You know, and me and her became very good friends. And she would just tell me about the balls, tell me about categories. And then when I'm hanging out in, you know, in Midtown, Octavia used to pull me with her to the movie. So I was kind of caught between Danielle and Octavia at that time. And, you know, that was pretty much it. And then they kept saying, you know, you need to walk a ball, go to a ball, and walk, and you can walk this and you can walk that. So I didn't know anything about houses, really, or how important houses were at that time. So the very first ball that I walked was Una Devine's ball in New Jersey. She had a ball. I can't remember
Una
where it was
Devine.
At. It was like a hole in the wall.
I remember
and I walked,
that.
I walked
remember
big girls
that.
Run. Huh?
I remember Una Devine. I remember that ball when you just said it. I remember that. Okay, I'm sorry, but just when you going when you're here in New York and you're talking about the scenes of your time, I've known you just when you since you arrived here in the Big Apple. So, you know, I remember that. But go ahead, Una Devine. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I had at that time I had watched, you know, Paris is Burning, and, you know, I just started learning a lot about stuff. I take that back. The first ball I attended was the Allure Ball that was at a high school in New York. I forget. It was, like, in Chelsea or something. That was the first ball I ever went to, and I was just so amazed. And then Una had gave a ball, And I wound up walking Big Girl's Runway. And I didn't know. I wasn't even a femme queen back then, but I had walked femme queen Big Girl's Runway because, you know, I didn't know what a femme queen was. I just knew that this is what I was doing. And I wound up walking, and I battled Sheila Jordan back then at the time.
Ooh,
and I actually won. You know, I didn't even know what I was doing, but I still won. And it was more because of my effect than anything, I think, because I was always big on the feathers and the beads and big pieces and stuff, and I used to sew a lot. Even when I lived in Atlanta, I learned a lot about sewing hanging around the drag girls, you know, the pageant girls. So, you know, I had created something and walked that ball. And they asked me, you know, what's your name or what house are you in? And I just said, you know, Jasmine Couture. And it was like, why Couture? Or, you know, what is couture or something? And the only thing I can think of at the time was, you know, couture always meant one of a kind and original, you know, original pieces, one of a kind. So I just was like, because I'm one of a kind. You know, something stupid and cheesy.
So wait a minute.
Me
so
being
wait,
a knot.
Okay, wait a minute. Yes, that was a very good word in the 90s. If you guys don't know, knot was a very... But wait a minute. So are you saying to us that you've never actually... You just went past my question that I had for you, but now I'm going to go into that different way. Are you saying that you've never been in another house? You mean that that's how the whole couture just came up? You just gave yourself this name?
That's how the whole couture came up. Yes, I gave myself the name couture. I gave it. Mm-hmm. Never was in a house. I care a lot about people's feelings and friendships. I never wanted to come between. You know, Danielle told me, you know, oh, you need to be my daughter. You need to be in a house of Revlon. Octavia wanted me to be a Saint Laurent. But, you know, I never joined a house because I didn't want to get Danielle mad at one time. I didn't want to get Octavia mad at one time. I didn't know about all the brotherhood, sisterhood thing back then. You know, so all I knew is I was friends. One minute I'm hanging with Danielle. One minute I'm hanging with Octavia. I go see them in Show World. They're both sending me to McDonald's. And then one minute says, she's going to bring me this back. She's going to bring me that back. I go to the movies with this one. I go do this with that one. You know, it was always like that between us. So I didn't want to come between them like that. And then another thing was, along the way, I also met, you know, as far as my hair goes, you know, I was put on to like R.R., you know, R.R. Chanel and Al Allure. Both of them also, you know, used to do my hair and keep my hair flowing and things of that sort. And I didn't want to come between my relationship with both of them, you know, by being either an Allure or, you know, a Chanel and stuff. So in order to keep everything, you know, cool between everybody, I just said, no, I'm just going to be my own person. So that's where I just always stayed at couture, you know, just one of a kind, you know, original one of a kind, you know, and left it like that. You know, that's how I felt at, you know, at that time, and I just always left it like that.
So when you just came up, when you came in the clubhouse, because I remember when you came in the clubhouse, and I remember the beads and the feathers, the clubhouse on 28th Street, the original, I remember the beads and the feathers and all of that stuff that you were doing. You just basically walked into it as couture, and that's it. Because I remember actually seeing that, so it just basically walked into as couture. And how have you spoke about Octavia and Danielle?
I learned so much from a lot of the icons in this ballroom scene. I took so much of what I learned from Danielle, you know, living right around the corner from her, us being neighbors. I took so much from Octavia as far as, you know, us being close. You know, I became very close with her family. You know, I had a dog where I was at, and I couldn't keep the dog where I lived at, and she wanted a dog so bad, I gave it to her, she gave it to her brother. You know, we were just, like, really, really close. We had, like, a very close bond. You know, R.R. played a major role in my life. He always has played a major role in my life growing up and, you know, in the scene at that time. So I learned so much from him. Also, Al Allure, you know, he taught me a lot as well. So I learned a lot of stuff from these individuals, you know, growing up in the scene. But I just never wanted to really be a part of a house. You know, I just felt very, you know, independent on my own. And I just left things like that, you know, because I didn't want to get caught up in the whole, you know, battles and, you know, the way things were divided between houses and, you know, in competitions and things. I just became my own individual.
And that's how you were different. Yeah, well, I've been, you know, I was there, and you were always different, and you were still bringing things to the light in the late 90s that people had stopped doing in the real early 90s. So that always, of course, was a good thing.
Yeah, when I started walking balls back then, you know, there wasn't that many categories that catered to the big girls. And so I wasn't afraid to walk regular categories like regular femme queen realness or face or things of that sort. Back then it wasn't called big girls face, in all honesty. You know, I don't care what anybody says, but I'm a collector. I have all the videotapes. The people who know me and who've been to my house, I'm the one who has all the DVDs from the 90s. Actually, videotapes. There wasn't big girl's face back then the way it is now. It wasn't a popular thing. But so I was one of the big girls who competed, you know, and walked. You know, I used to walk in the name of Avis. You know, I was always told, oh, you look like little Avis. You're like a little Avis. You know, Stuart used to say that, and Selvin used to say that and stuff, and little Avis and little Dorian and little things like that. But I was the only one that was walking those categories. So they at major balls back then at the Y and at the Mark Ballroom, they would have these feathers and beads and extravaganza, but I would be the only one walking. And I got tired of walking it by myself, so I would walk realness or face or, you know, things like that. And that's what I would always constantly do, but I would always walk independently.
So that's where the couture come from. I know. So I would say, is it safe to say that name is very, very, very special and sincere to you? And the
yes,
way you have never let go of that name at all. Anything you have owned and anything you have been a part of, I've noticed that you have never let go of that name. Okay, so when did you decide then, after living in the mid, late 90s in New York City and, you know, getting yourself into the ballroom scenes and opening up the House of Couture and et cetera, when do the turning point come?
Well, back then, I got kind of caught up in life, in the ballroom scene a lot. Every Wednesday, going to the clubhouse, always hanging in the Village. There wasn't a lot of balls going on like there are now. But, you know, I was always at a ball when they were around. But, you know, we always had the little mini balls at the clubhouse. And
that's what kept
us alive.
I
got together with Frankie Paradise, who was, throwing, the Wednesday nights and at the clubhouse, and I said, you know, we should give mini balls and stuff. So we started giving mini balls, and every house would give a mini ball every Wednesday. And I just started getting more deeper into it. You know, I would give a ball, and Aphrodite would give a ball, and everybody would give balls. But then it was starting into the drinking, you know, the hanging out, not really, you know, having life. And I wound up not, you know, getting off of welfare and hustling to make money. And then as I was hustling and the rooming house that I was living at, probably the third one or so, I wound up getting kicked out of it and wound up moving to Queensbridge Projects with a butch queen and, you know, sleeping on his floor, you know, on a futon mattress. And I wound up living there for about 2 years with him. And he was really cool at first. You know, it was really cool. This is when I was going through my transformation as well, really taking, you know, hormones and, you know, little things like that, you know, becoming, you know, a woman. You know, I was going through a big transition living with him. I used to do shows at Crash and Sally's.
Crash, I remember that.
Esquilita's and stuff. I used to do shows every Monday and things of that sort, you know, to drag shows and, you know, make money and also walking the beat, you know, hustling and making money and stuff. And I used to pay the butch queen that I was living with, you know, like about $200 a week living on his floor. And, you know, he was on Section 8, probably paying $68 a month for his apartment. But I still didn't mind contributing, you know, to the house when I had it. And then to make a long story short, you know, I wound up meeting a guy, and me and him started getting, you know, started getting real close, and, you know, dating and stuff like that. And, he, you know, we really didn't have a lot of privacy where I was living at and, you know, with the Butch Queen. And the Butch Queen used to pull dates. And one time he pulled a date, you know, got a piece of trade to come over. And when the trade came over, the trade was more into me than it was into him. And, you know,
well, we all know
how
that story went.
Yeah,
okay.
When he seen that happen, he, you know, he kind of went a little crazy, and we got into a big argument. I told him it would be best if I left, and I wound up leaving. Well, I said I was going to take that back. I said I was going to be leaving and finding a new place, and I was going to start looking for a new place, and I left just to go hang out. And when I went to hang out, I seen one of his friends, and they said, I said, where's Kenny? And he said he's doing spring cleaning. And I said, what does that mean? And then I kind of caught it. And I said, oh, my God. And I said, let's go. We got in the cab and got back to the projects. And a lot of my stuff was outside, all over the building. And everything pretty much was, like, kind of gone. And when I went to the door, the locks were changed. And even though the housing police knew that I lived there, they wound up letting me in. And he was sitting right there frying chicken. And he's talking to me in pig Latin, saying, I just served you, and I got you, bitch, and da-da-da-da-da. Ooh. Ooh. And the only thing I wanted was my mattress, because I had about $3,000 in the mattress. Mm-hmm. And the mattress was gone. And I said, where is my mattress? And he said, you have to walk around these projects and find it. And I didn't care about nothing else. And I said, oh, my God, where is the mattress? And I was just devastated. I had nothing. Everything was gone. No clothes, no nothing. Everything. Everything I owned was gone. Stuff that I did have, like, you know, my pieces and stuff was all torn and all around the projects, feather hats and everything. But all the clothing, everything that I owned was gone. So the clothes that I had on my back was all I had left. And I went back. I didn't know what to do. I was like, I knew I didn't want to go back home to Patterson. I didn't want to call my family. And I wound up going, you know, back to Midtown and Karen Covergirl. Back at that time, you know, whoever knows Karen Covergirl, Miley. She pretty much seen me and she said, Mama, you can come stay with me. And I wound up staying with her, but I couldn't stay there because, you know, it interfered with, you know, her work, her, you know, her career. So I didn't stay there long. I only stayed there for a couple of days. And I reached out to RR, and RR pretty much really helped me at that time. RR told me, you know, I shouldn't be in that environment, and I was more than welcome to come to him. And I wound up going to his house, you know, for a few days. And he had a good friend that was into real estate that worked around the corner from where he lived. And between RR and his friend, they wound up finding me a nice rooming house over in Brooklyn. And RR helped get me set up. And I was able to get back on my feet again. And I was, you know, and, you know, had my own again. And RR really helped me with that, so... Kudos to RR.
Yes, definitely for the iCar. That's, yes, kudos to RR. We need people like that, a lot more leaders today like that coming around that can lend out a helping hand regardless of how, you know, they're so old.
Hello? What happened?
You in Brooklyn, sorry, my phone went down.
Okay.
So once we was in Brooklyn, you in Brooklyn, and okay, you
yeah,
got established.
Yeah, so pretty much when I was in Brooklyn, I realized that, you know, the guy that I was dating with, he kind of stuck with me through everything I was going through at that time as well. But, you know, RR got me situated where I was at, and it was time for me to, you know, start doing things. And that's when I got my first laptop at that time. And when I had my laptop, I could never put it down. I always was creating something. I started creating flyers at that time, created flyers for the awards ball, created flyers for other houses, for the mini balls at the, you know.
The clubhouse.
At the clubhouse, you know, RR used to say, bitch, every time I come over here, it's either a sewing machine or a laptop. You know, it was just always that with me, and that's when my mind was just so focused on, you know, this computer. And I, you know, ever since then, I never put a computer down. But that was the beginning of I want more now. I want more. And I had this laptop, and, you know, I was always doing something. I was always creating something back then. Back then it was called, like, it was like an IBM ThinkPad. You know, that's how old it was. But that's what I was always into. And the guy that I was dating at that time, you know, me and him had our own little place now. So, you know, I'm feeling really fab. You know, I'm cunt. I got a boyfriend. But, you know, he's trade, you know, but he's into me and things of that sort. But then I went through the whole, you know, he's trade, but he wants to date girls, but I want to, you know, he's going to still live with me and this and that. And, you know, it was just a lot with that. That was just like driving me insane. And, you know, I kind of felt a little insecure at the time, like, oh, I'm a big girl. I have to settle for this. But what are you going to do? And me and him used to always argue and fight over this because I knew that, okay, I'm not going to stand for it for too long. Me and him just got into a lot of arguments, a lot of fights. And then, you know, I fight. So, like, you know, he would, you know, throw something at me and I'll try to pick up something and literally shove it down his throat, you know, all the way down his throat where he's like coughing, throwing up and stuff. So, you know, we used to kind of go crazy at that. And this was always because of some cunt, you know, that's knocking at the door, or, you know, this is when beepers were out, and somebody's beeping him 911, or, you know, some bullshit like that. And he used to also hustle drugs and stuff at the projects around the corner. So, you know, this is the life that I'm living. So as he's out there hustling, I'm over hanging in the village and hanging on, you know, in the clubhouse and stuff. But when it was pretty much the end of it is when he got involved with a very, very violent crime. And he pretty much had to, you know, leave Brooklyn. And he wanted to go. And he's like, come on, we have to leave. And I'm going to change my life. And I'm going to promise you this. And I'm going to promise you that. And we wound up going to Chicago just to get away for a few days. And, you know, he sold me this story of, you know, we should stay here. We should not go back. We should stay here. You know, he was making good money, hustling. So he's like, we should stay. We got a couple of thousand. We should stay here and do this and that. And I didn't know what to do. So I prayed. I prayed to God and I asked God. I said, God, is it meant for me to be here? Is it meant for me to stay? You know, what do you want, you know, what do you want me to do? Because I don't know what to do. I knew the life I was leading in New York, and, you know, I knew I wanted more. So I picked up the paper, and I seen that they were hiring for a customer service representative immediately. I called the number, and they said, oh, you can come in for an interview today at 4 o'clock. So I had some nice clothes with me, and I got dressed and went to the interview. And when I got to the place, it was HBO, you know. HBO was actually hiring there for a customer service agent for their channels. And, you know, the HR manager fell in love with me, and she said, I'll hire you right away. When can you start? And I said, I live in New York, but, you know, I'm considering moving here. She said, well, how long will it take? And I said, well, I can get back in within a week. So she said, okay, I'll hold the job for you. So we went back to New York, FedExed everything. Crafted all my stuff to be FedExed the next day, as much stuff as I could. A lot of stuff broke, but wound up moving to Chicago. Got a little studio and moved to Chicago, and I was working. You know, I started working for HBO, and he pretty much sat at home. He couldn't do nothing because, you know, he was pretty much on the run. I was harboring a fugitive, and I just worked. But I loved it. You know, I loved the fact that I was working, and I worked for this company, and I grew so much within the company. You know, I started off as a customer service rep. A few months later, they made me a team leader. I was a supervisor over my, you know, my group, Then I wound up becoming a marketing manager. I just kept growing. And every time I seen these advancements, it made me feel so much better. And I left the ballroom scene alone. The ballroom scene really slowed me down, and I felt it. And I knew that when I left that ballroom scene alone, I left that the pageant world alone, the ballroom scene alone, the queens alone, I felt my life changing and growing. You know, it wasn't keeping me up all night. I was actually waking up to do something the next day. You know, I had something to look forward to, and that's what it did for me. And that's how it was. It wasn't easy, though. You know, working in society, you know, being who I am, it wasn't easy. You know, back then my paperwork still had my male name on it. You know, even though a lot of people respected me where I worked at, you had some nasty, nasty people there.
All the time.
And, you know, there used to be this one man, Leon, that's the one man that would always say, "Hey, sir, you know, how you doing, sir?" You know, just being so disrespectful, you know, and it was just, you know, I complained so much about it, but I was dumb. You know, I kind of took it in, but I was done. But I didn't want to say too much because I didn't want to get fired because I loved the job. But then I started learning more about myself, learning more about my rights, learning more. And I said, okay, enough is enough. So then that's when I started getting into, if you say it one more time, catch what happens. And then that's when I threatened them, you know, with discrimination suits and stuff. So I pretty much, you know, it stopped at that point. And I grew. I grew within the company, you know, and became, you know, management over our department and stuff. And it just kept happening. One thing I've always had was intelligence and that thrive for more. You know, I never settle. I always want more. You know, maybe that's why I'm so big.
How long were you in Chicago?
I was in Chicago for a few years. I was in Chicago for a few years for the turn of the century. You know, I was there for a while. Our department winded up, you know, closing down in Chicago. This is when HBO and Home Box Office and Turner Broadcasting merged, and our department, you know, basically our clients basically were being run out of the Atlanta Turner building. So I wound up actually being told I can take a severance package or I can actually go work out of Atlanta. And I said I wanted to go work out of Atlanta, and wound up moving back to Atlanta and working at the Turner building. And I was there for about a good 8 months working out of Turner, but I felt myself actually getting caught up again, you know, being in Atlanta, you know, hanging out and stuff like that. And, you know, the department I was working for, again, winded up actually just, you know, going down. The one department that started going down. And wound up getting a large severance package, a few thousand dollars, and parted ways with the company. And I, you know, I said to myself, I didn't want to be in Atlanta, and I don't want to go back to New York. So what do we do? And we wound up getting in a truck and coming to Florida. Took my money and came down to Florida and got a place, and I've pretty much been here ever since. And that's, you know, that's when I decided, you know, I wasn't going to go working. I wound up, as soon as I got to Florida, I wound up working for another company, and I was with them for about 8 months before they got brought out by another company. So got a little severance package from that as well. Then I got tired of working for these jobs and, you know, them being bought out by other companies and stuff, and I said, okay, I'm tired of working for the man. I need to do something on my own. So that's when I started creating my companies, my businesses, and you know, I took it from scratch and started doing it from there.
So how did the whole $5,000 club come about, and what year did that start?
After working for some time, I was working for years creating, you know, my businesses and stuff. I was always sitting behind a desk for so long. I've gained a lot of weight just sitting down, not being mobile, working for 12 hours a day, making tons of money. I remember having a conversation with my accountant and him telling me, you need to get up, you need to trust your business with other people, and you need to start doing more with yourself because now it's getting unhealthy. You know, start going out there. You know, he was like, buy a car, buy a house, do this, do that, travel. So I knew that it was, you know, okay, maybe I can settle down and do other things. You know, let, you know, hire people to take care of some of the responsibilities where the workload is not so hard on me. And, you know, start doing other things. So I started thinking about balls again. You know, I started wondering, mm-hmm. you know, what was happening with the ballroom. You know, we didn't have internet back then like we do now, so there wasn't really, you know, ways of finding out. But I stayed in contact with a few people, and I remember speaking with Jihad, and mm-hmm. me and Jihad have always been close for years, and Jihad and Dre, and I invited him down to Florida to my house, and we talked about a ball that Jihad was actually coming up, you know, that was coming up that Labor Day weekend, which was the making of the Legends Ball.
Mm-hmm.
And I said that I wanted to come back to the ballroom, but I wanted to come back with a bang. And, you know, I wanted to actually create, you know, I wanted to start something. And, you know, we talked about it, and we said that, you know, what was the hottest category at that time, and it was Femme Queen Face. So I said it. You got to excuse me, I'm smoking. I said, I want to make it for $5,000. You know, I want to make it for $5,000. And, you know, they kind of gassed a little bit. And, as you know, we planned it. We put it together, you know, to do a $5,000 category. And that was Labor Day weekend of 2004 at the Making of the Legends Ball is when I returned. And, I donated $5,000 to that category, and that was the very first time. And only two people walked, you know, Raquel and Ajnay. A lot of people were intimidated. They'd never seen a category so big. So many people were scared. Where's the money coming from?
Right.
A lot of people didn't know about me. You know, no one trusted the money at that time, and it was like a lot that was happening. So they kind of gagged, and that's where it all started. I said I wanted to do it. And when I got the, you know, I got that urge, the addiction again, you know, and then I said I want to do it again.
Well, how many times have you given out $5,000 as far as being a part of the $5,000 club?
Well, I want to say at least as far as the $5,000 club goes, it has to be about maybe 9 to 10 times I've given out $5,000. Back in the very beginning, I would just, you know, contact the promoter themselves or the house and, you know, just make the category. We would get together and make it the hottest category of the evening. I would get nothing in, you know, nothing in return for it. You know, that wasn't the deal. I did was just my money and what I wanted to do. I would go through the, you know, the promoter themselves and I did it. First one was, you know, Femme Queen Face. Then I did got with Andre in the awards ball in Atlanta and did Butch Queen Performance that Deshaun won.
Mm-hmm.
Then I did another one and another one. Then I started the collections, but it was like, girl, you need to give your own little ball. And, you know, I wound up doing the very first collections ball at 708 in Atlanta. That was in 2005. And that's where I did Best Dressed for $5,000 and Kadon mm-hmm. and Andre walked. And Kadon won. You know, it wasn't even a lot of people there. It was probably like 250 people. Because a lot of people, this is just so new to everyone.
No, right, yeah, I can understand.
And then after that, I wound up doing it again for the New York Awards Ball. I did it for the Legends Ball. I did it for the House of Balenciaga Ball. I just kept doing it. And I started it, you know, started the process back then. And then a lot of people kept saying, you know, she's stupid. Why is she giving out her money? She's really stupid. What is she doing? She's buying her way into the ballroom scene. She's buying her status, and she's buying this, and she's buying friends. But what people didn't realize back then was when I came back and gave that $5,000 and I caught everyone's attention, it was a business investment. It was more of, I'm about to play Monopoly with this ballroom scene, and I'm going to give this ballroom scene what they want and what they deserve. And I spent a little money here, spent a little money there, spent money there. But then after a while, being involved with so many balls, New York Awards balls and Capitol Awards balls and collections balls and stuff, made the money back, if not more, so many times. You know, it was more or less I wanted to give the people what they wanted by also creating a name, creating a legacy, you know, creating something that they look forward to, something that they can depend on, not, you know, not your rent balls and not your greed balls, but really giving you what you want.
Right.
And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Wow, wow. Okay, I have a real good question. Is, you know, if there's all in time and all this time and all this stuff and everything, at what point in time were you decided to change your whole sexuality?
After my department closed down in Chicago, I was involved with a lot of people from overseas and stuff that were actually, you know, I also was taking classes at DePaul University in Chicago, and I was involved with a couple of people from overseas, people that were actually in the medical field that were working with me and actually going to school and stuff, and, you know, we talked about things. And, you know, what my goals were. And part of my severance package, I knew what I wanted to become. You know, I was seeking, I was under medical, you know, evaluations at that time and, you know, medical supervision and things of that sort. I was, you know, on my hormones and, you know, taking care of myself. And after I received my severance package, I took some of that money and had my change.
Oh, congratulations. What's that like?
It really didn't make a difference. I mean, it makes a difference, you know, personally, as far as, you know, the body goes, but mentally, I mean, it makes a difference physically as far as the body goes, but mentally I've always felt, you know, the same. I've always, you know, known what I wanted to be. I always felt what I was. I always just felt that I had something that just shouldn't have been there. You know, and it just didn't belong there.
I think a lot of people feel like
glad
that.
To have it removed.
I think a lot of people here, or people on the line that listen, feel like that as far as about their thing down there. Good luck. But, okay, who else to you about
one
that?
One of the biggest complications from it, you know, was, you know, just a lot of the, you know, your body adjusting, you know, weight gain, of course, and, you know, things of that sort. But, I mean, otherwise that, you know, I don't regret anything. You know, I've had some complications, you know, back then as far as health goes, you know, already being a big person and going through this. But I don't regret it. Very
Ms.
happy
Orla,
with it.
Is there any $5,000 that was giving out that you weren't in totally agreement of as far as the ball, or you giving someone $5,000 for a category? Was there anyone that unfairly won the $5,000 in your eyes as long as you've been doing it?
I wouldn't say necessarily unfairly won. Like, I walked out of there and I felt like, child, I should have just kept my money. I just felt that, you know, I wish it was more competition. I came to a point where I had to realize that as the name grew, as the, you know, whole series was growing, that it would just get bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right.
It wouldn't happen overnight. So in some tokens, it was like, oh, the first $5,000, only two people walk. The second $5,000, only four people walk. The third $5,000, here we're back to two people. And then, you know, when we go to, you know, the New York Awards Board, when it was Club Kid Face, okay, finally, we have a group of people that are going to walk. And we did it at the I did it at the Legends Bowl. Okay, we had a group of people that walked. It started getting bigger. You know, so I wouldn't say I regret anybody that walked or felt bad or, you know, or anything when I did it at, you know, at the Balenciaga Ball and Ayana won for Sex Iron. Okay, we have a group of people that walked. You know, so I wouldn't say I regret it. I just say I just wish sometimes people weren't so intimidated by the money. The biggest thing that happens is a lot of people see a category of a large amount of money and they get so intimidated they don't want to walk. They're so afraid. They're afraid it's either a setup. If they're afraid they can't get it together. They're afraid that somebody's going to get chopped. They're going to get chopped. They get so afraid and they're so intimidated by it that they lose out. So that's the only thing that gets to me sometimes because I just wish people can become. So I'm just going to leave this in the hands of God. I'm just going to get on that runway and do what I can do. If I don't walk out a winner, at least I made a statement, but I did. I took the chance. It's like playing the lottery. It's like playing, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, anything like that. It's gambling, so you're taking that chance.
Right.
That's the only thing that ever discouraged me about the whole collections itself, but I never pretty much felt bad about any winners.
Okay.
I love all my winners. I keep very, you know, very good communication with all of them. I talk
okay,
to them
wait.
All.
At my discount, what I want to do is I want to give a chance for you to the switchboard to check and see if there's anyone that would like to say anything to you. I do think we're probably going to have your life story is a very long story, and it's very listenable. You like just sitting there listening and hearing you speak, and I appreciate you for all that. But we may have to do a part two because I'm on my way. I need to get outside, and I want to give somebody on the callers or any callers on the phone line that has been listening to Jasmine tell her story, her life, and her dreams, and what it have become today. If y'all want to press one, I know you guys been listening for so long. Maybe you guys would like to say something, you know, drop a comment or two. Please feel free to press one, and we can get somebody on the phone line. Yes, you all guys know my birthday is Thursday, so I'm trying to go out and meet my fam and have a little bit of fun because you got to be there for Jasmine. So, Switchboy, is there anybody on the phone line, anybody that want to say anything or would like to say something to Jasmine? If it's okay, Jasmine, maybe tomorrow if you have – I know you have a business and things of that nature, but on a Wednesday night, would you like to come up here and share part two of your phenomenal story? You've been all over the world, isn't it, bitch? I mean, moving from state to state to state to state to be where you is today. God bless you. Like, okay, that's cool. But what I didn't know, Jasmine, is the whole time you were really more familiar with Florida. I didn't know that. I didn't know that it went way before. I thought when you ended up there, it was like after everything. I never knew that that's where you actually started as far as moving in your family. So that was very interesting to know. So if somebody's on the phone line and you want to press one and you have something you would like to say to Jasmine and all you guys that's listening, definitely remember the Collections Ball and this one. What number would this be? Collections number what?
Number 5.
Collections number 5, a weekend event, the Lifetime to Remember, darling. October 15th in Richmond, Virginia. Grand prize is $5,000, and $10,000 goes to the house with the most trophies. So why you guys can press one? Now I want to ask one more, you know, really question, and I'm hoping that we can arrange something where I can speak to you tomorrow. But what made you up the ante, you know, like 3 days a week, 3 days, the whole 3 days a week, all the accommodations that you have brought about and, you know, looking for the travel arrangements and noticing where the hotels, hey, what was it about it that you wanted to up the ante?
I knew the categories were hard for people, you know, it's a large amount, you know, that they're coming for. I knew that, you know, a lot of people were going to need as much help as they could. That's why, you know, did it for the whole weekend, you know, so
mm-hmm.
they can have time. And just tried my best to assist everybody as much as I can, you know, especially with it being in a new location for myself and for everybody. We all can help each other. So that's pretty much why I did what I did.
Okay. And just for yourself, after you're giving out all this money, which one of the movies would you like to see in the Grand March?
I look forward to all of them. You know, I'm a big fan of creativity. I love horror. I love makeup. You know, I love special effects. I love creativity in itself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Those type of movies I'm a very big fan of, you know, even with horror and horror makeup and, you know, things of that sort, or sci-fi with aliens and, you know, Star Wars and things of that sort. I love that, you know, Star Trek, things of anything. I'm just a big fan of that. So anybody that brings those things to life, you know, it impresses me.
Oh, okay, okay. And for the $10,000 and all the different things, so that pretty much goes for the grand march and for the ball itself as well, right?
Yeah, most definitely.
Oh, okay, okay. That should be fun. Everybody should find out. All of you guys should be very creative and do all the different things that she's asking to win, because remember, guys, you have $5,000 on one hand and you have $10,000 on another. The thing has been uppered, so let's go upper it and get some of this money. May the best man win. So, Jasmine, will you be available for me? It's just that time. Everybody's going off calling me. Would you be available for me tomorrow where we
can
have a bigger, more platform?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah, I can be available tomorrow.
Okay, so all you callers that has not pressed one, if you'd like to be...
We have three callers that pressed
okay,
one.
Okay, well, yep, I'll take the callers. Yes, I will. What is... my first caller, please.
571-297.
571.
57297.
They're not listening? They know? No?
347-533.
Yes, hello.
Yes. Hi, welcome to the Sister For Real show. This is an interview with Jasmine, CEO of Couture. What would you like to add?
I'd just like to say I appreciate Jasmine keeping it 100 about her life story. But as long as I've known her, she's always kept it 100. I guess that's why a lot of the girls can't take her. This is the pioneer icon, R.R. Chanel.
Yes. Hi, R.R. I was listening to your voice. You sounded really young there. Hi, how are you? Thank you for coming.
Well, I am young, you know. I've been taking that young juice.
Okay, no problem.
I just wanted to congratulate Jasmine on her upcoming weekend and giving the kids always something to look forward to. And also, I just wanted to ask you a question. Do you think that when you're going through the transformation, a lot of girls think that, you know, they can just go from being a butch queen in drag to becoming a femme queen to becoming a full-op sex change without therapy? Do you think that therapy is important before you make that big decision?
I think therapy is very important, you know, for a lot of people. You know, because it changes you. It's going to change you in general, and you have to make sure it's something that you want. You know, I don't want to sound kind of cold or anything when I say this, but there are still a lot of girls who, you know, to be blunt, like to use their piece, you know, and things of that sort. You know, realizing that you're going to lose things, you know, it's like a person that's, you know, loses, they're so used to certain things on their body, like, you know, eyesight, hearing, things of that sort. And when you actually, even a finger or, you know, a toe or something, you're actually losing a part of you that has always been with you. It can play a major role in your life. With me, it didn't play a major role because I always felt that it was just something that was in the way, you know, and it didn't bother me. But for a lot of people, I even still, you know, had to come to grips with, you know, just losing something that was always a part of you. So having that therapy helps you out with even something as simple as that, and even as something as simple as, you know, mentally, you know, if you're brought up under a certain religion, or you're brought up under certain beliefs or family, or, you know, just adjustments in society and things of that sort, you know, how will you fit in knowing that you have changed your life in general, physically? You know, it's just always good to try to have it. You know, it comes with the territory. You know, you have to do it. And so if you're doing it the right way, you have to get the paperwork anyway, so take advantage of it. But you know, at first you probably walk in and say, oh, I don't what they're gonna tell me that I don't already know. But then you wind up starting to listen, and you know, I went to group sessions and stuff, and you actually start learning more about other individuals as well as yourself in comparison and things of that sort. So you know, it helps out. It doesn't hurt at all. I think it plays a very important role with you.
I don't want to take up too much more of your time, but when you say what I'm understanding from you is you're saying it's a personal choice. So when someone makes that personal choice to transition totally, this is an individual who's made up their mind that they're really, really, I won't say convinced, but they're in their spirit and in their heart and in their mind, they
mm-hmm.
truly believe that this is their calling. Whereas someone
mm-hmm.
who has not made that transition and refuses to make that transition, they've made the reality of themselves that they're comfortable at this part of their life where they are, and they don't want to go any further. So do you believe that there's a part of an individual who wants to have a female characteristics without losing the anatomy, and then there's another part of a person who wants to have a female characteristics totally?
Yeah,
if you understand what I'm saying.
I believe that there's room for both of them. They both have their beliefs and stuff. Maybe, you know, for some reason they just don't want to go through the change, but yet they still want to live the lifestyle, and they just don't want to take it to that level for whatever reason. Maybe it's something that they enjoy doing behind closed doors or something like that. Maybe it's their beliefs.
Well, thank you so much. And, you know, as always, you know, I love you till the end. So I will definitely see you this weekend. And congratulations once again, and much success on your ball. And I want to thank you for having this show, because it's good to see you doing something positive.
And thank you, R.R. Thank you for coming on this show.
And I'm going to wish you an early happy birthday. And everyone, continue to be blessed. Have a good evening.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And that was the pioneer icon, R.R. Chanel. It was nice to see
you
on the show. Is it
we have a private caller.
At that said, we never know where I live at.
Private caller.
Nobody on this line know where I live at.
Well, we know what you sound like.
Three to record, 9 for spam, and 0 to bail.
What? Oh, my God.
What? 917-345, you're on the air.
Hello?
917-345.
Letitia, are you still there?
She's gone.
Okay. Is there any more else callers on this line? Hold on, makeup on this
line. No, that's it.
Well, I am going to say I thank you so much once again, and I greatly appreciate it. And tomorrow, you guys, you can catch the ending part on Jasmine, the CEO, Couture, who has been around in a lot of places for a very long time and blatantly just sat here and said that we can overcome anything throughout every trials, throughout the deaths, throughout the losing of a people, the ups and the downs, the moving of our own situation. We can...
You got another caller. Real quick.
Okay.
347-440. You're on the air.
Hello, Nicole. Hello, Jasmine.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. I forgot my question. No. Damn. Shit, I forgot my question. I've been pressed one like 2 hours ago. Fuck.
I'm so sorry.
Keep talking. I'll remember in a second.
We are not going to go through this with you.
Well, like I said, I'm going to keep talking like you said, that anything can be overcome. I hope by all of you out there listening and you out there who've heard this story can go tell somebody else this story, and that you can make it. You can overcome the obstacles. You can overcome the bad things. You can overcome health issues. You can overcome financial issues. You can make it. All you have to do is kneel to your knees and pray to the Lord or whichever God or whoever you believe in, whatever high and mighty spirit that you have that you may pray to, then that's what you do. Just keep the faith, have some strength, and you can do the same thing. And then maybe it may be you to come back to the ballroom scene. And, well, she just upped the ante because she's giving $10,000 out of the way. So maybe somebody can come along, Jasmine, you think? give 20, you know, with after their history and everything, and after all the things they probably have went through, you know, they can come back and give about $20,000 to the next generation. So you can be that person. She is the first lady to start the $15,000 club. She is the first lady of the collections board. She is the first lady, your CEO of the House of Couture. She can do it. You can do it. So if you guys would like to see here the rest of the story, I would love for all of you good to join me tomorrow on Wednesday, same time, same place. And we can finish this thing. Wherever you guys do tonight, whatever you are, wherever you're doing it at, please use condoms. Please be safe. God bless you all, and I love you all. Jasmine, I love you, and thank you for coming on the show. And I'm going to give time out so you can say goodbye to everyone. Because I'm on my way out.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. Real quickly, I guess tune in tomorrow and we'll continue this talk. And answer any questions that you guys have last minute about the collections ball. Feel free to call in tomorrow. Order categories, I said, would be up today. They're actually done. You know, I've been sending them out to some of the leaders of the houses to kind of go over and see if there's any adjustments. Everybody likes them, so most likely I'll have them up for you tomorrow. For, you know, the general public, but a lot of your leaders have them already. You know, tune in. If you guys have any questions, hit me up on Facebook, call me up directly, and I hope you enjoyed the show. And for you people that didn't, I was actually just reading in the chat room, you already know what you could do for me, right? Go ahead and do it. So I'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Have a good night.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you.